We live in an age of political polarization and preference bubbles, of economic change, rising threats, and a rapidly changing world. Canada needs to stay relevant. We need more smart conversations. We need to dive into critical issues and big ideas with passion and unrestrained optimism. I'm Aaron O'Toole. Welcome to the Blue Skies Podcast.
Welcome to Blue Skies. The Blue Skies Podcast talks a lot about geopolitics, deglobalization, the uncertainty in the world that it's facing Canadians, folks in North America. It's facing our Western alliance and certainly our friends in the United Kingdom. And that's why we're so fortunate today on Blue Skies Podcast to be joined by MP Alicia Kearns, a leading voice both in her work before politics and now in the House of Commons in the UK. Alicia is the MP for Rutland and Melton. She was elected in 2019 and in 2020 started serving on the Foreign Affairs Select Committee and on the China Research Group, given her background in foreign policy. In 2022, Alicia became the first female chair of the Select Committee on Foreign Affairs, bringing her expertise in diplomacy and counterterrorism and global risk to Parliament. I love that professional experience being part of the House of Commons. She was educated at Cambridge and worked at the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office before her election. She lives in Langham, a village in her riding, with her husband and two children. Welcome to Blue Skies, Alicia.
Thanks so much for having me, Aaron. It's always a joy to talk to you, and even now more on a podcast for the first time.
Well, it's been a few years, but we appeared on a discussion on CANZUC, and we talked China and things over the years as I was Shadow Minister of Foreign Affairs and then leader of the Conservative Party. But before, let's start. Tell us a little bit about your riding. Where is Rutland and Melton so that Canadians can kind of see where your riding is? Because we know there's an election coming later in the UK. Where's your riding?
So it's in the very heart of the country. In fact, I would say it is the beating heart of the country. It's very, very agricultural. So obviously our, what we call constituencies, but your ridings are nowhere near as big as Canadian ones are. So they're meant to be about 76,000 people. Mine is far bigger than that at the moment, but it's made up of about 187 villages and three market towns. Now, these are not towns by Canadian standards. These are our lovely, lovely British kind of chocolate box towns. So it's very agricultural, 413 farms, the home of Stilton, where afternoon tea was invented. So it's a really wonderful part of the world. I'm very, very fortunate.
True jolly old England, and it's well represented in Parliament, I will say that. So you are a busy person, so we're going to do a sort of, you know, top hits in terms of some of the issues your committee is facing and the world is facing. And you and I were on a panel once with an Aussie, you, myself. I had to get up, I think, at 4 a.m. in the morning to be the Canadian on the panel. But we were talking about CANZUC, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, those Commonwealth partners doing more, four of the five eyes working together. And it was particularly important when it looked like President Trump was pulling away from multilateralism that close allies like our countries could do more together. Well, there's no CANZUC, but there's AUKUS, and there's no CAN and AUKUS, unfortunately. So talk a little bit about the AUKUS relationship and how important it is, particularly in the Indo-Pacific and the geopolitical scene.
So I think AUKUS is absolutely a fundamental cornerstone for UK security going forward. And I would put it in line with NATO and also Five Eyes in terms of its importance for us. So I think getting on board with something that is going to be that significant for our future is, of course, a big challenge. I think it needs a complete whole of government response. I'm worried about the fact that in the UK, it's currently based in the Defence Department, whereas actually I think it needs to have everyone involved, particularly all the science and tech and what people often call the kind of sexy bit, you know, Strand B, Pillars 2 and 3. So I think it's a massive, massive project, and it's a complete change to our entire concept of security. And yes, it's primarily naval, but as I said, it's also all these other different areas of work that are going to make us safer as a country, but also our ability to help keep our allies safer is going to be even more intense than it was before.
Well, you touched a few things there that I want to probe. You said it shouldn't be housed in MOD, in defense, and it's as important than NATO and the Five Eyes. Is AUKUS, at least Pillar One of AUKUS, really just about submarines and about, you know, common kit? And is it just a defense alliance? Because, of course, we're the Five Eyes friends sort of sitting on the sidelines crying, saying, hey, we used to be part of all these important military alliances. Is it more than just that sub deal from your perspective in the UK?
It really is. And yes, submarines are of vital importance more and more as we see increasingly aggressive actions in our seas by hostile states around the world. And obviously Canada will be looking at that very heavily as we see, you know, the melting of ice and obviously increased freedom of movement for certain hostile states around certain parts of the world. But it is as much about that pillar two, the technology, you know, submersible technology, you know, hypersonics, AI, you name it. And so this is an enormous opportunity, but also economically, this is a real opportunity for us to burden share, but also to really invest in those technologies. Because one of the biggest challenges is that over the last 10 years, when we all thought we were opening our doors, let's say, honestly, let's name the thing we're talking about, the Chinese Communist Party, we all opened our doors and we showed them our market economy and our democracy and our values and our rules-based system. And we were either arrogant or complacent enough to think that they would see it and go, yeah, we wish we were in that world with you too. Let us in. Let us reform, change our system. It's not about CCP party survival above everything else. And obviously, that's not what happened. And the challenge is that, like any business that would plan to fail, there should have been two strands of work. One, that kind of showing them the way that they could follow, and the other, building up the deterrence, the resilience, the protection within our system from where they make us vulnerable in the future. And because none of us in the Five Eyes, let alone more broadly, did that deterrence or resilience work, us grouping together now in AUKUS might give us a chance to catch up, because the CCP is definitely focused on technological advancement. That's what they're spending the next, you know, between now and 2050, the next 25 years focused on. So if we're going to catch up, we're going to need to work together.
Great point. I think we in the West, UK, Canada for sure, were naively optimistic that the opening up of trade and opportunity and globalization would bring shared values, not just economic interests. But in the 20 years that we've been focused solely on building trade and opportunity, China built a blue water navy, and now there's tensions in the Taiwan Strait. So AUKUS, in terms of the submarine deal, certainly I don't think Canada has the capability, the personnel, or the ability to even have a nuclear submarine fleet. We're going to look at upgrading our diesels. But do you see a role for Canada in Pillar 2? You alluded to Pillar 2 being that enhanced military capability, innovation, hypersonics, subsurface, all these sorts of things. Is that going to be a way for us to get into AUKUS? Or is Pillar 2 AUKUS the kids' table at the Christmas dinner?
It's definitely not the kids' table. And look, no alliance is immune to tensions. And I think AUKUS did kick off with quite a lot of tensions, whether it be with the French or whether it be with the Canadians. I think there's a real challenge, though, in that in Canada, defence is not enough of a national discussion. And that comes from, you know, inherently your geography, you know, where you're based, the freedoms you have, the protections you have as a result of the relationships, and of course, your brother to the south. So I think there's real questions around whether or not Canada could be relied on to commit what would be needed to make AUKUS a success. Because at the moment, Canada is not meeting its defence commitments as a NATO state. You know, the Trudeau government has chosen not to hit 2% of defence spending, 2% of GDP on defence. And as a result, NATO is struggling. There is no question that NATO needs everyone to hit 2% if we are going to help Ukraine survive. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that later. But I therefore have questions, even though Canada has shown, you know, real kind of leadership on AI and signal intelligence, if it's not going to deliver the hard weight, which is the money and the investment and the technology that we need, it can't be a reliable partner. And my concern is at the moment, you know, you don't see it being a big political issue as we come towards a Canadian election. And that's a concern for me, because we are an alliance. We stand firm, we stand strong, or we all fall. And so I think at the moment, I don't see a place for Canada in AUKUS, because I'm not convinced they're committing enough money to defence spending to be able to do that.
It's reality from a friend.
I know, I'm so sorry. I would love to see Canada in Pillar 2, but I just don't think it's a reality. If you're not meeting your NATO commitments, why would you meet AUKUS commitments?
Oh, I think you're right. Certainly, when I was conservative leader in 2021, we had a plan to increase defense spending. I think our allies, I think the pressure you're applying in a nice way, Ambassador Poe and the U.S. ambassador, it's coming from the right place. But let's talk about Ukraine, because you talked about Canadian complacency really coming from the embarrassment of our geography, surrounded by three oceans, and then our brother to the south, our brother from the same mother, if we're going to keep that analogy going. Yeah. The English-speaking peoples, Canada stepped up before the United States in both World War I, World War II. We used to be that reliable partner. NATO is challenged, as you said. And let's talk about the biggest challenge, Ukraine. There's now really a push where Democrats in the U.S. may support a Republican Speaker of the House in order to save his skin, but allow a vote on an aid package to Ukraine to reach the floor and to get done. With the U.S. in a bit of political turmoil over additional aid to Ukraine, is the U.K. doing enough? Is Canada doing enough? Are the other partners in NATO, certainly the lead partner is the United States, but is there a role for the other NATO partners to do more? Certainly, President Macron has taken some pretty aggressive language in terms of doing more for Ukraine. Where is the UK going, particularly in an election year? Are you spending and giving enough military aid, or do you think you need to do more?
So I think we all need to do more. And if anyone says anything different, I'd say to them, well, what happened to Nadivka? You know, the fact that Ukraine had to withdraw from Nadivka should shame us all, because they had to withdraw because we did not get them enough munitions. And it's horrifying on the second anniversary of the renewed illegal invasion that we have world leaders celebrating the fact that Ukraine was still standing and independent, whereas actually we should be apologising for the fact that they are still having their people murdered and killed every single day, civilians and those who are bravely fighting. So we all need to do more. And Europe really has been on a journey. I mean, if you look at Macron, you know, in March 2022, you know, all the way through to the not that long ago, he was talking about how we had to make sure we didn't humiliate Putin. It was really important we didn't talk about Russia losing. We just talked about Ukraine winning. And he's done a big U-turn. You know, he really has changed his tact on that. He now recognises and says that Putin must lose. The Germans, you know, the great Zeitenwende, for them that has been, you know, real, you know, entire country, their entire population have gone through an entire change in the way they think about defence. But the reality is too many countries still aren't meeting their 2% GDP on defence. And they are NATO countries who benefit from that security. And we can't all sit there and say Ukraine is fighting for us all, but then say, oh, but I can't find 2% of GDP, sorry, to spend on defence. And I just find it really interesting that the countries who are doing the most are the countries who are the smallest. So Lithuania, you know, 1.6% of their GDP has gone to Ukraine alone. That's not their NATO commitment. That's just to Ukraine. You know, we keep seeing Scholz tie himself up in knots about Taurus. Give them Taurus. We have to give Ukraine enough, not just to survive, but to win. So the UK does need to do more as well. But it's interesting because we all play different roles. And when I meet with Zelensky, he's very clear with me that the UK has provided the strategic leadership in terms of when they have needed new equipment. The UK has found some form of equipment. It may not be exactly what they want. So, for example, the tanks, you know, we found a form to give them so that others then move forward. Jets, training, long-range missiles, you name it, the UK has always been the first to step forward in some way, and it has then pushed other countries to join in and to give what they can. So we need to do a lot more. In terms of a UK election, I genuinely don't think you will see a difference between if it is a Labour government, a Conservative government and a Labour government on this. We are completely united in Parliament. And my US counterparts, when I was in DC a month or so ago, couldn't believe me. They didn't believe the fact there wasn't a single British MP that would stand up in our parliament and say, let's stop helping Ukraine. Let's reduce our support for Ukraine. That is not a discussion. And so it won't form part of the election. But what will form part of the election is, should we be moving to 2.5% of GDP? Should we be moving to 3% of GDP? We recognise the threat and we know that serious action needs to be taken. But Europe itself needs to step up, but we need Canada as part of that.
Yes, and the UK, I think the difference, if I can suggest it, I know you can speak to it better than me, having been part of wars in Europe twice before that had generational tolls on society, your parliamentarians don't want to see that happen again. And again, this is the blanket of security that distance gives the Americans and gives Canadians, the some of the anti-Ukraine misinformation, other things, is leaking into our politics as well. In fact, our party has been a little soft on support from Ukraine for Ukraine recently, which is too bad. What I've been pushing, and I'd love your thoughts on this. You're already talking about overall increasing to 2.5% of GDP for NATO. Do you see the opportunity to do more for Ukraine, give more military assistance to Ukraine, and update your military capability at the same time? Almost give what you can now and create your arsenal of democracy to kind of manufacture and replace it, not just submarines and AUKUS, but new ground forces, new drone capability. Is this an opportunity for a reset of capability for the UK military?
It's exactly that. And it has to be a symbiotic relationship, because we've realised there isn't enough defence industrial complex for any of us to be able to do what we need to do to protect our people in the worst eventuality, as we are seeing. And there is a real challenge. But actually, for example, the UK has just announced a new joint drone development capability with Latvia. So we've both said, look, we both need this. Let's work together and let's enhance our drone capabilities. Ukraine is going to have the most equipped and the most war-hardened and trained and best-trained military in Europe once it has its freedom, once it has defeated Russia and the threat that Russia still poses to its neighbours. So Ukraine needs to be part of that future because of how much we've invested in them. But you are absolutely right about the working together. And the one thing I would say about the Americans, you know, there is this Freedom Caucus who I think genuinely, if World War II was tomorrow, they wouldn't come to Europe's aid. But the vast majority of Republicans are Atlanticists who believe that they have a role to play. They want to support Ukraine. And it really comes down to the Speaker. And I think it's really disappointing to see the Republican Party allowing itself to be recast, and that my party can't really talk about how many times we've recast ourselves over the last few years, but to allow themselves to be recast as people who don't want to support Ukraine when the vast majority of them do.
Well said. And I think the Americans will always get there. And it's just sometimes not a straight direction. And I think we're seeing that now. And they're in an election year as well. That'll be fundamental to not only the future of NATO and support for Ukraine, but I think for geopolitics, because the holiday from history we've been having in the last few years, the deglobalization, we really require American leadership to ensure that there's stability and the rest of the NATO partners can help. One but final thing on Ukraine
I'd love to ask you, please. Actually, what do you think a Trump victory means for Ukraine?
I'm very worried about it in terms of a lack of support. I do think misinformation by Russia has become so commonplace amongst what I would say the populist right in North America, including in Canada, but to a much lesser degree, so that Trump actually thinks he's representing true opinion of the American people, when in actual fact, that opinion has been crafted and shaped through misinformation on social media. I know you did some of this in your Foreign Office work, working on misinformation. While China is the subject of a lot of headlines now, this was really invented by Russia. And I think the MAGA Republicans, if we can call it that, have been captured by this. And it's always easy when the economic times are difficult and there's inflation and cost of living crisis and a displacement of a working class population to say we don't need forever wars or to say we should spend our money and help our people. Those are very compelling narratives for people who are upset. But that's what leadership means. It means we require members of Congress, members of Parliament, to show the fortitude to do the right thing, and then to marshal public opinion in your point of view. You do that very well. It's why I've been a fan of yours since your election. You tackle the tough issues. And so I think that's going to have to happen. And I think the Republicans will have to have a come to Jesus moment, I think, and maybe that's an appropriate analogy in the case of our friends, to say, what does the Republican Party represent? Is it the party of Ronald Reagan and peace through strength? Or is it going to be this populist, misinformation-led party? Mm-hmm. you're going to get me ranting, and I want to use your precious time.
No, but final thing, point that people don't hear enough is that people think, oh, but I'm repeating what people say to me down the pub, or I'm repeating what people say to me when I'm queuing for my paper on a Sunday morning. But actually, you have to think about the information environment they're living in. But also, it is our job as elected parliamentarians to challenge that thinking, to marshal that thinking. And people will still end up possibly disagreeing with us, and a lot of people always will. But it is our job to elevate and to challenge that thinking, not just to regurgitate it.
I salute that. You're 100% right. In my final speech in Parliament, Alicia, I said, politicians have to be careful not to become followers of their followers. Because sometimes if you gauge your self-worth as a parliamentarian by how many likes or forwards your tweets or your social media posts get, that is a mug's game. Doing the right thing sometimes is going to not attract a viral moment. But you're not elected to be a social media influencer. You're elected to lead your people and your country. So that's why I think you and I have always seen eye to eye. Final thing on Ukraine, though.
Parliament, come give that speech. There we go.
I'll send you the YouTube link. So Macron's boots on the ground comment about Ukraine freaked everyone out a little bit. But there has been a lot of talk for a few years about training on the ground. Is there a role for NATO and allied parties like the UK, Canada, France, to do training on the ground? Because now Zelensky's getting into the conscription of young men in Ukraine, and there needs to be the training. And they really can't, in a war like this, send them to the Baltics or to Poland. Is there a role where NATO could do some limited training on the ground of Ukrainians to prepare the new recruits for the fight?
So it's absolutely possible, but I think our assessment of our current Ministry of Defence is that it's actually not necessary, in that we have been able to bring in hundreds, if not thousands, and I should know the numbers and I don't, so forgive me, but I would assume thousands of Ukrainians have come to the UK to be trained. There are these beautiful scenes of our soldiers lining up to kind of, you know, see them off as they go back. And actually, we've had no difficulties in terms of people coming over. We've had no difficulties getting them here, no difficulty doing the training. And then they go back. And being able to train in complete safety, being able to train on the best possible training grounds, the best environment and the best training kit, you know, none of that kit is on the ground in Ukraine at the moment. So in terms of creating that training footprint in Ukraine, it would require significant investment, significant moving of equipment, significant moving across the people, and it would put far more NATO troops on the ground in danger. And of course, there is a risk that they could be hit during training, because let's not suggest that Russia isn't still flying missiles over Polish territory, let alone across the whole of Ukraine. So I think our assessment is that, yes, of course, it's possible. But at the moment, the UK is more than happy to keep bringing Ukrainians to the UK, where we can train them in the right place, in a safe place, give them what they need, and then put them back in ready to fight, rather than halfway through every single training running into a bunker and having to hide, or worse, you know, losing lives while training.
Yeah, good point. I think that's been a really good effort to date. I think the one issue we'll have to track is whether the conscripts, the folks that are of fighting age that haven't joined yet, taking them out of the country, you might not get them back. That, I think, is a bit of the worry. But look, we talked a little bit about Canada and the US sometimes being completely disconnected from the European security theater because we haven't lived through occupation and or countries that lived under the Blitz. I visited Chartwell just a few weeks ago with my daughter when I was briefly in the UK, talking about a country that was worried about invasion. So that makes you appreciate defense more. The Balkans have flared up, and you've been one of the strong voices supporting Kosovo and that state that 25 years ago this spring, it was NATO intervention that gave Kosovo its freedom. It's trending in all the right directions, but we're seeing these old tensions return, particularly in the Serbian populated areas of Kosovo because of interference by Serbia. You've been a strong point. Do you see this as a worry now that the world is becoming, caught by conflict around the world? It's allowing some countries to lean on its rivals and control its near abroad.
I'm extremely concerned about the Balkans, and I have been for a long time. What you have in the Balkans is a complete failure of deterrence by the EU, the US, and although the UK isn't in the driving seat, we have to equally be culpable because we haven't yet demonstrated that we are showing meaningful deterrence. We have an autocratic state, that being Serbia, where we have elections that are completely, completely captured, completely broken. We've recently had a declaration from the EU about just how corrupt those elections were and all the false election interference and activities. You know, people being shipped in from neighbouring countries to take part in order to make sure that President Vucic is re-elected. And we have to remember this is a region that is still living and recovering from the trauma of the 90s. You know, President Vucic was the propaganda minister for Milosevic, a man who committed a genocide. You know, the Srebrenica genocide, they're still looking for the remains of the people who were murdered. Because what happened was towards the end of the war, the Serbs went in with giant tractors and they spread the bodies, the remains, across multiple sites in the hope of hiding just how many people they had murdered. And what we've seen over the last year is a gradual escalation, not only in the rhetoric, so the demonization of Muslims once again, but also language about how Kosovo can never be independent, how it must be part of Serbia. We're seeing all sorts of threats all the way through to first foreign state interference, so Serbia interfering in Kosovan elections. Then we had the local mayoral elections in the north of Kosovo, which is often considered to be a breakaway area, which it absolutely is not, but it is the Serb majority area of Kosovo. We saw mayors take up their positions there, which was, without question, raised tensions and made things a lot worse. And that wasn't done in conjunction with the US and the EU and the UK. So that was done by the Kosovan government. But the response was militia groups who came in with Molotov cocktails and attacked NATO soldiers, many of whom lost their limbs and will never walk again as a result. A few months later, we then saw the kidnapping of police officers when Serbian forces went across the border and illegally kidnapped them. The response from the international community was nothing for Serbia. In fact, Serbia was allowed to participate in a US military training exercise just 10 days later. But Kosovo had sanctions put on them by the EU because of what happened with those mayoralty elections, which again, they shouldn't have done, but they did it and that was their decision. And we have had tough conversations with them about it. And then in September this year, last year, we saw a terror attack. And it's easy for people to, I think sometimes when you're watching the media, just pass by when terror attacks happen. This was incredibly serious. This was a group of people who had trained in a Serbian military site for weeks on end before crossing into Kosovo armed with, you know, anti-tank mines, armoured vehicles, you know, guns, military. The equipment they had is not, you know, leftover Yugoslav kit. It's not black market kit. It is top grade military equipment with the serial numbers lining up. And there is no question that the Serbian government was in some way involved in this. It could not have been perpetrated without their endorsement. And the problem is that there has been silence as a response from the international community. There has been no sanctions for Vucic or for Serbia. There has been no publicity or public report into what happened, even though the international community has come to conclusions about what happened. And so what you are seeing is a country, Serbia wants to join the EU, they say, but they are the only EU country, accession country, that hasn't sanctioned Russia for its renewed illegal invasion. In September 2022, after the renewed illegal invasion, they signed a security agreement with Putin. They are always in and out of Moscow, and they are also in a deep relationship with China. So what we have is an autocratic state being allowed to do as it will, threaten as it will, and yet it still has, it receives 60% of all funds from the EU for the whole of the Western Balkans. We are in a really dangerous place, and that's, let alone when you look at everything else that's happening in the region. There are other countries that are vulnerable, not least Bosnia, where the Republika Srpska secessionist area is threatening to break away. So I am really worried about the Balkans because it is a small neighbourhood, Europe, and what happens in the Balkans is felt across the whole of Europe.
Seen that going back to Archduke Ferdinand.
Exactly that.
You would think we'd learn, because what you're talking about, this kind of phony war being funded and supported by Serbia, is very much similar to what Putin did in the Donbass region, right? And suggesting it was local people with local kit, yeah, when in actual fact, intelligence showed it was directly supported by the state. So should we be ramping up the KFOR mission? Should the EU be sanctioning? Is that what you think the solution is here in the short term?
So I think, first of all, the EU should be lifting the negative measures that they've placed against Kosovo. Secondly, there should be rerun of elections in Serbia, but this time with proper monitoring and without the shipping in of people from across neighbouring countries. And also, all municipal elections should be held on the same day in June. We need to see the US publish its report into what happened in Banska, so-called Banska terror attack, because I know they've done an investigation, they're just refusing to release it. And then we need to see meaningful deterrence as a result, which means, yes, punishments for those who are behind it. You cannot have 30 people in top gear go into a neighbouring country and try to commit a terror attack, was only averted thanks to the incredible work of the Kosovan police, and just get away with it. What message does that send?
Indeed. So in the final few minutes I have with you, Lisha, I'd like to speak about China. And we started AUKUS, and really the reason for AUKUS in part is the rise of tensions in the Indo-Pacific. But there was huge headlines just in the last few days of the APT-31 cyber attempts to intercept the email system of UK parliamentarians. Probably people like yourself. We're going through a national inquiry right now on foreign interference by China in our last two elections, including in the election I was part of. Are you doing enough? Is the West doing enough with these United Front operations? I saw last year there was, or 2 years ago, there was a warning given to Westminster staff that there had been agents or at least foreign inclined people find their way into staff offices and things like this. Are we 10 years behind this problem in your view, and what should we be doing?
I mean, so let's look back at what happened in the UK. The Chinese Communist Party hacked our electoral organization, the organization that sees the safe conduct of elections in our country. They took the personal details of people, they took internal emails from the electoral from the organization, its control systems, you know, all sorts of information. And the repercussions from the UK government were to sanction two individuals and one firm. It's taken them 3 years, and they think that deterrence is two individuals and one firm. The US, and it's not the US Electoral Commission that was attacked, the US sanctioned seven people. Now, I'd still argue that seven people is not deterrence, but it wasn't even the US that was attacked, and yet they have done more in response to this than we have. And yes, we are calling it out, and thank goodness, we have finally changed position when we actually call out the CCP for these sorts of activities. But given the intent behind this, which is to undermine our democracy, and it is one of the most significant cyber attacks in history done by a supposed ally, I do not understand how our response can be so muted.
And with an election in the coming months at some point, Prime Minister Sunak, I guess, is the only one who might know. Are your safeguards ready? I know you were a leading voice within the Tory caucus, and we talked about this years ago, to express concerns about Huawei in the core of your 5G network. Is there enough being done to safeguard your elections this year, in your view, or does more time and money need to be spent?
So we need to do a lot more. And we now have a Defending Democracy Task Force that's run out of our Home Office or our Interior Office. And that's led by Tom Tugendhat, who's a great guy and who, you know, jointly set up the China Research Group. So that is good. And there is a lot of work being done, particularly around transnational repression. We have a real problem with autocratic states trying to dance in our backyard and even conducting assassinations. But the problem is, all of the examples the government gave at the dispatch box a few days ago when they gave that statement about what they have done to be tough on China of late, all of those were driven by the backbenches. Huawei, improvements to the procurement bill, the fact that we're reducing their access to nuclear, things like that. That all came from backbenchers like me fighting for those changes. You know, we've only just got government agreement a few weeks ago that we are going to ban foreign states from being able to buy our media. Because, as you may have known, there was this bid for the Daily Telegraph and the Spectator to be purchased by a foreign state. Now, it's nothing to do with that exact foreign state who was applying. But surely, if we want to defend our democracy, and look, the media don't give me an easy time of it. The Telegraph definitely doesn't. But if our job is to ensure they can hold us to account for the safety and betterment of our democracy, the fact that we only just agree to ban foreign states from buying our media. Now, there's nothing wrong with foreign individuals, but foreign states shouldn't own our media. So we've got a long way to go on defending democracy. And the challenge is we will always be playing catch up. Because like an organised crime gang with the police, the organised crime gang is always going to be more innovative. They're always going to be quicker and they're always going to be changing their patterns. And we're always getting behind because we're trying to play catch up. But we can do more than what we are currently doing.
Not just media, TikTok. Too, I'm sure you have the same view as me, is we should not be giving them a way to map our populations and to manipulate issues. But that could be a whole other hour in itself. I'm mindful of your time, Alicia. I always try and end the Blue Skies podcast in an optimistic fashion, because blue skying is talking about issues with unrestrained enthusiasm and optimism. In your time in public life, and you replaced Tom as the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, you've already made an impact. Think of one thing that you feel you've already accomplished in your parliamentary career that you take a lot of pride in, whether it's on a foreign policy issue or in your constituency, because we need more good people like yourself to step up into public life. And if you look on social media, it doesn't look attractive to most people who can do well. It's not. So to try and make sure that people of your quality still run for office, what's something that you already feel quite proud of in your parliamentary tenure?
So I think it is a domestic one, actually, which is, if you remember during the pandemic when we were all so scared and we had no idea what was coming or how life was going to be changed, in the UK, a rule was put in place that any woman giving birth was not allowed to have their partner with them while they were in labour until the very end stage of labour. They had to have miscarriages on their own and so on. And this obviously is a safety issue. And we saw an increase in both infant and mother mortality as a result. And I launched a national campaign where I had to fight hospital by hospital until they overturned this rule. Because if you are at home, I can't believe this is how far we've come from the pandemic. I can't remember the word for when you had to stay at home with one person. It was called, well, anyway, you're home in a bubble.
Social distancing, isolation,
isolation. You're at home in isolation with somebody. The idea that they are bringing more risk to the hospital when they've come from the same house that you've been locked in with them for the last 3 months is preposterous. But the result is that, as a result, the UK is just finishing passing a new law where enshrined in law will be your right, whether you are in a care home or whether you're in a hospital, to have visitors and to have an advocate. So never again will we ban people where they end up stuck in hospital beds or stuck in care homes, unable to advocate for themselves, feeling lost and actually put at risk. And that for me is really important, whether it's your mother living with dementia or whether you're giving birth to a baby. So that's something I'm really proud of.
This would be Bravo Zulu, as we say in the military. That's great. And it's not you're a foreign policy expert and you're well known on these issues. And it was an issue facing families and some of the strains of the pandemic. So listen, we could go on for quite some time on all these topics. Thank you for your advocacy. Thank you for your friendship with Canada, with me and with the Commonwealth. And best of luck on the hustings whenever that election comes. And maybe we can blue sky something with you again in the future.
I love that. Always, Erin. And have a wonderful rest of the year.
Thanks, Alicia.